Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour. Thanks so much for joining. I've got a great interview for you this time. I'm going to be speaking with Emily M. Bender and Alex Hanna, co-authors of a new book called The AI Con: How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the Future We Want. And so we're going to be diving into AI and this idea of a con. And it really focuses on hype. And I'm sure you have noticed, friends, in recent months, the sheer amount of hype that Silicon Valley is pouring into its various AI investments, telling us that AI is going to change everything. It's going to usher in this utopia. It's so great. You should use it for everything. And they want to put AI inside everything. I mean, the promise of this technology rivals anything I've ever seen in my long tech career. They're putting everything on AI, and the hype is as thick and as inflated as anything I've ever seen or heard for any of the various tech fads that have come and gone. And this book really goes into what's behind the hype, what is the promise, and what is the reality of AI. And as the title suggests, quite often the systems produced by Silicon Valley are found wanting. They do not live up to the promise, the sheer inflated hype of Silicon Valley. And so we're going to be diving into that. I want to note something about the authors, which I think this will help put their comments in context. Emily M. Bender is a linguist, and Alex Hanna is a sociologist. And so the complementary skill sets of these two guests, these two co-authors, I think really make for a rich conversation. And if you want to learn more about the AI Con, you can go to the playlist at WFMU.org, click playlists and comments, or go to tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm, and click the playlist link for the AI Con episode, and you can get links to the book and some other stuff. Let's go ahead now and listen to my interview with Emily M. Bender and Alex Hanna, co-authors of the book, The AI Con, here on Tectonic. Emily M. Bender and Alex Hanna, welcome to Tectonic.
So glad to be here.
Thanks for having us.
I'm excited to talk about the new book you've both written called The AI Con: How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the Future We Want. It's published by HarperCollins. As you put it early in the book, artificial intelligence is a con, a bill of goods you are being sold to line someone's pockets. We call this type of con AI hype. You go on later in the book and give lots of examples of AI hype in the workplace and healthcare. We'll get into that. But just for starters, can you say a little more about how AI is a con?
Sure. It's a con at multiple levels. And I'm going to give sort of like the down close to the machine level. But at the lowest level, when we're talking about large language models in particular, it is a con or a parlor trick that plays on how we work with language. So out comes this plausible looking text, and, you know, eager linguistic creatures that we are, we make sense of it. And in making sense of it, we have to imagine a mind behind the text. And that gives the con men this in to sort of say, see, we've made a smart thinking machine. And then they build on that in various ways.
Yeah, and it's a con as a socio-technical system, insofar as, well, first off, there's not one thing that can be called AI. There are many different things that are getting lumped under the label of AI. But when we're talking about generative AI, and specifically large language models, there is this false equivalence of the large language model with a type of mind, and there's an anthropomorphizing of it, and they're saying this technology can do X, Y, and Z. It's going to completely revolutionize so many different industries, and they really bank on a lot of tropes from science fiction, and then that is leading folks to then buy into the notion that this is more than what is actually happening under the hood. And it has a lot to do with how, as Emily said, we interpret language and what this text extruding machine is actually doing. And it also has to do with how these things get spoken about. So they're anthropomorphized, they are assigned genders sometimes. They say she, her, they say ChatGPT told me, they say has PhD level intelligence, and so on. So you wouldn't say, you know, calculator has PhD level intelligence at multiplying numbers, right? But this is a rhetorical move to say this is something more than it is. And all that is being used to rank in, you know, billions of dollars in venture capital from all kinds of different people who are willing to get on board.
And all of this is wrapped up under this umbrella term of AI. And I appreciated that you wrote about AI as a term, saying, quote, AI is a marketing term. It doesn't refer to a coherent set of technologies. And then you go on to say, every time we write AI, imagine we have a set of scare quotes around it. Or if you prefer, replace it with a ridiculous phrase. Some of our favorites include mathy maths, a racist pile of linear algebra, stochastic parrots, referring to large language models specifically, or, and I think this is my favorite of the ridiculous phrases you offered, systemic approaches to learning algorithms and machine inferences, aka salami. And I've seen people online use salami as a replacement for AI when the tech bros make these grand pronouncements about AI, then just say, oh, you know, salami will save the world. Salami is sentient. And that's very fun.
Yeah, that one's actually due to Stefano Chintarelli, an Italian researcher. And it predates the current massive wave of AI hype. It's earlier than the ChatGPT moment, for example, but it is so apt. And it, exactly as you say, like if you drop in salami, the utter ridiculousness of the claims becomes clear instantly.
Yeah. Salami is a fantastic term, and I appreciate that. The mathy maths one is one that I rattled off, I think, in maybe one of our first or second podcasts. I think racist pie of linear algebra I saw floating around the internet someplace. But I mean, I think all of these things are helpful to take the veneer off it. I mean, the same way in which we don't really associate, you know, blockchain or NFTs or cryptocurrency, you know, they muddle the waters. And this is a marketing term. One of the points we also make is that it's always been a marketing term. It's always been a way of getting people into the same room or to avoid trying to, you know, have conflict with other types of intellectual communities. And another point we make is that it hasn't been the marketing term of choice. You know, it was sort of unsavory to say you were working at artificial intelligence during the AI winter of the 1980s. You know, you would speak maybe more specifically about working on image classification or natural language generation or something of that nature. But now everything's been collapsed into AI, and that has to do a lot with the people and the principles behind this stuff.
I wanted to pick up on another one of those terms, stochastic parrots, because Emily, you have an intimate connection to that, as you were the person who coined the term. You co-authored a now famous research paper called On the Dangers of Stochastic Parrots, Can Large Language Models Be Too Big? And I want to say something about what happened with that paper. But first, since you're the expert here, could you tell us, what did you mean by stochastic parrots?
Sure. So that was a phrase that I coined in the context of writing that paper. And one thing about the title of that paper is that we liked the phrase so much, we put a parrot emoji in the title of the paper. When we submitted the copyright paperwork to the ACM, the Association for Computing Machinery, it choked on the emoji. And so I had the great pleasure of telling the ACM that their systems were not Unicode compliant, which was fun. So the purpose of the phrase is to try to make vivid what it is that language models are doing, because it is so compelling to see well-formed language coming out. It is very hard for the average person, including the average computer scientist, to keep in mind that what's being manipulated there is not words. It is actually literally parts of word spellings. And a word has both form and meaning to it, but what's being manipulated by the large language models is just the form part of that. So that's where the parrot bit comes in. This is not about, you know, actual parrots who are lovely creatures and I'm pretty sure have internal life, but there's an English verb to parrot, which means to repeat back without understanding. So playing on that verb, but in noun form. And then stochastic is important because it means randomly according to a probability distribution. And a lot of people will say, well, they can't be stochastic parrots because they give new things. They're not just giving back what's in the training data. It's like, well, yes, that's what stochastic means.
Okay, so we have this paper on the dangers of stochastic parrots. And in the context of that paper, you write about how the owners and billionaires around these AI platforms seem to have a goal of devaluing us as humans by promoting their platforms. And in fact, Emily, you had an interaction with OpenAI CEO Sam Altman on this very point. After the paper came out on the dangers of stochastic parrots, Sam Altman responded to it on Twitter, posting that, quote, "I am a stochastic parrot, and so are you." And as you both write in the book, quote, "With his tweet, Altman suggests that humans, too, are little more than machines that manipulate strings. AI hype reduces the human condition to one of computability, quantification, and rationality." And I liked that quote a lot, and I agree with it. I want to make sure listeners understand. Sam Altman would probably say, well, of course, all we are bags of meat that do computation and quantification and rational thought. Please educate us, Emily and Alex, how humans are more than that.
Yes. So I'll start on this, but first, actually, with a historical correction. First, I'm not sure that was really an interaction with Sam Altman because I don't know that he knows who I am. The paper was written in late 2020. It was leaked to the press because of all of the drama around my co-authors getting fired. And someone at Google decided they should leak the paper, not anyone associated with the paper. So the paper has been a known thing since about December of 2020. That tweet from Sam Altman comes out well past the release of ChatGPT, I think. And in the interim, the phrase stochastic parrots comes to signify, on the one hand, what we meant it to signify, which is like, here is a vivid description of what these machines are doing. But it also gets taken up, unfortunately, as an insult, because people who are over-identified with large language models and therefore think of them as the kind of thing that can be insulted, which is already a category error, found that description demeaning of the large language models. And so I think what Altman was doing, on the one hand, was trying to like reclaim the term that he had seen as an insult. And on the other hand, as we say in the book, really devaluing what it is to be human. And to go into the linguistics of it a little bit more, people say this to me all the time. It's not just Sam Altman, but like, you know, they'll say, how do I know that you aren't just, you know, repeatedly predicting a likely next word? To which I say, this is not a conversation I actually want to have because I prefer to have conversations with people who will posit my humanity and, you know, realize that I have an inner life and that when I'm expressing myself, I'm choosing my words because I have communicative intent and not just randomly following patterns. This isn't to say that people don't have pattern matching as part of our experience. We are definitely sensitive to patterns, but we also have inner lives and intent. And when we are communicating with other people, we are making a kind of a connection and not just repeatedly spitting out words.
Yeah, I would just add to that to say, I mean, it's not, you know, as we mentioned in the book, it's not just Altman who is making this connection. It's, you know, we talk about Minsky and Marvin Minsky, and who in a 1956 paper said human beings are instances of certain kinds of very complicated machines. So this kind of computational metaphor comes up again and again. I mean, Altman's not unique amongst this. And I mean, debating, well, like, how do you know that we're not that? Well, first off, you're working backwards. You're taking something that was originally a metaphor that was taking words from neuroscience, like neuron or neural net. You're applying it to a single node that is an encapsulation of a mathematical function. You are then developing an architecture, and then you were asserting with no evidence, or really in much of the evidence, that this is how brains work. This is how the human brain works, which is not, you know, that's, it's a metaphor that doesn't work. And it's one that is, well, we took this term from neuroscience, and now we built this thing, and now you're asserting this is how the brain works. And I'm like, that's not how this should work.
Okay, let's dive in a little bit to some examples in the various categories that you cover. You've got one chapter whose subtitle is AI Hype at Work. And here you're talking about, of course, the effects of AI on the workplace and labor and employment. I want to give a summary of this chapter by quoting one sentence you had, which was, AI is not going to replace your job, but it will make your job a lot crappier.
Because it's almost what we wrote.
It's the PG version of this.
It's the FCC-friendly version of the quote, which wasn't exactly accurate. But I appreciate it because we hear a lot from the boosters of these technologies that AI is going to revolutionize the workplace. And they'll even trot out that tired lie from the last 200 years, ever since the Industrial Revolution started, that AI is going to automate everything so accurately and so conveniently that we're all going to have time left over to write poetry or do whatever we want to do. But you're saying, no, it's actually going to make employment less convenient and less pleasant.
And less well paid.
Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, this happened. This, something comes up every day with this. And I mean, it doesn't take too much digging. Today, Dario Amodei, the CEO of Anthropic, you know, I guess they did an interview, a very credulous interview in Axios. He said AI could wipe out half of all entry-level white-collar jobs and spike unemployment to 10 to 20% in the next 1 to 5 years. You know, journalists just print this stuff. They just really assert this with no evidence at all. It's really upsetting that this is happening. There's pretty little evidence of direct replacement. There's little evidence of systematic productivity gains. I think the most systematic study that we have so far, and this has been making the rounds, has been this NBER paper, has found very little evidence of this. I mean, it seems, I think the estimate of productivity gains has been what they called a precise zero. And then if there have been places where there have been productivity gains, those have been offset with increases of tasks, so new workplace tasks. So the first part of that is taking your job. The second part is making your job crappier. There's been many cases that we've seen in which employers have not been hiring people like graphic designers or coders at higher rate because they still want people to be using these tools. And what that's tending to do, it's tending to displace the labor to somebody else in the supply chain. So a good example of this is folks that I spoke to in the Animation Guild. And one thing that they've mentioned is like, well, some person, some principal can ask a text-to-image generation model like Midjourney, give me an image of a dragon fighting a knight or something. What that will produce is like a flat file, you know, a PNG or a JPEG or something of the sort. But this has to go through a supply chain. I mean, it has to go to someone else in the workflow. And so if somebody is asked to clean it up and edit all the sloppy artifacts, they still have to import that thing into something like Photoshop and recreate it layer by layer. And that itself is taking a huge amount of time, right? So if I have this image and you pass it from one editor to the next, they could take this Adobe Illustrator or Photoshop file, edit up that layer, clean it up. You know, it's a 10 to 15 minute job. Versus if you take this flat file and you say, edit this out, I mean, that could take a few hours. So now you're offsetting that labor. And the real idea here is that principals and managers and C-suites think that it's actually saving time, but no, it's really upsetting someone else's workflow and really causing them to do new things and adding on to their workload.
speaking of these tasks being offloaded to other people, you also write about how workers in what you call the majority world are often asked to do the tasks that are too unpleasant or even dangerous for white-collar workers here in the U.S. You write that jobs rarely go away whole cloth. They shunt some types of labor, especially those that require specialized human intervention and skill, into the margins where workers are more easily exploited. And this is something I've covered a bunch on past shows, talking about content moderators for Facebook and other big tech companies being exploited in exactly this way. And OpenAI, of course, is following suit and doing the same thing. You continue later in the chapter. Most AI tools require a huge amount of hidden labor to make them work at all. Time magazine reported that OpenAI had subcontracted Kenyan workers making less than $2 a day to filter out gore, hate speech, child sexual abuse material, and pornographic images from ChatGPT and OpenAI's image generation tool, DALL-E. These workers were lured in by the prospect of breaking into the lucrative field of computing, but ended up with PTSD and ravaged personal relationships due to mental health issues. And I'm sure, Emily and Alex, you could bring up many other examples. This is just one that you highlighted in the chapter that is case in point about how labor is changing as AI is being adopted.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to shout out folks who have done original work on this too. I mean, we highlight some of this research and some of this reporting. So I do want to give a shout out to people who have done a lot of that hard work. And so originally, Billy Paringo had reported that story in Time, and then Karen Howe and Deepa Sitharaman had reported it out for the Wall Street Journal. And then at DARE, there's a researcher, Mila Michelli, who's led a team called the Data Worker Inquiry, in which they have invited many of these data workers as co-researchers to tell a lot of their own stories. And many of them are at dataworkers.org. Folks like Fasika Burhani have talked about the PTSD that she encountered being someone who was escaping the Tigray genocide, moving to Nairobi, taking a job with Sama, and having to moderate much of that content extensively herself. In Karen and Deepa's work, they spoke to somebody, his name is Mofat, and he talks quite a lot about how he was so traumatized by this. He had a family where he had a wife and a stepchild, and he had been so traumatized and was behaving in such an erratic way after experiencing so much of that content. They ended up leaving and couldn't tolerate being with him. And so, this is, as you probably are well aware, part of a well-trodden strategy of moving work that is unseemly in the global north to the majority world. And we can surely see that in the terms of AI research, in terms of content moderation and other data labor.
I just want to add here that the content moderation and the work, content moderation of people's posts on social media, but also moderation of what comes out of the synthetic media machines, is arguably some of the worst, most grueling work. And you described it as too dangerous for, you said, white collar people. And it's too dangerous for anybody, right? Like, it's one of these things where the need for content moderation, given large platforms, makes sense. But you can ask, well, how did we end up in that position? Why did we put ourselves into a position where we now have networks where people can spread awful things to millions of people at once? And so we have to be doing content moderation. But the need for content moderation for the output of synthetic media machines is only a true need if you think the synthetic media machines themselves are necessary. So that's one thing. There are also other cases where the labor gets pushed off out of sight. And that process is always dehumanizing, because the laborers get basically turned into resources that the tech companies can access through an API as if they weren't people. And, so in addition to Karen Howe's amazing book, Empire of AI, where she goes into a lot of this, there's also the book Ghost Work by Mary Gray and Siddharth Suri that details quite a bit of this. And that's important reading. And some examples that are somewhat less horrifying include things like those Amazon Go stores, where supposedly it was computational systems using image processing that would track what you were picking up. It was videos being monitored by people in India. And we also go into an example of these allegedly self-driving cars that are monitored and assisted by a workforce in Mexico. So it is work of, in that, those cases, someone who's a cashier in your store, in your community, or let's say a taxi driver, again, part of your community, being made invisible behind this machine interface, but it's still people on the other end.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Emily M. Bender and Alex Hanna, co-authors of the new book, The AI Con: How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the Future We Want. And as I said before, I have put links to the book and some other resources on the playlist, which you can find at tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm. Click the playlist link for the AI Con episode. Let's go ahead now and listen to the second half of my interview with Emily and Alex here on Tectonic. Now, some listeners may be wondering, how does all this impact me and my job? I'm not a content moderator in Kenya or India or wherever, but a lot of listeners, I'm guessing, are beginning to see AI creep into the platforms that they're forced to use at their jobs, whatever they happen to do. And in fact, you both cover this aspect of AI as well in the chapter. You write, "Someday soon, there may be a point where you'll not only be encouraged to use ChatGPT, but you will be required to use it. We're already clearly in the encouraged stage on many platforms and enterprise products. Google Docs and Microsoft Word nudge users to turn on AI writing assistance. Microsoft-owned GitHub states proudly at the top of each code repository that you could be coding faster with Copilot. If your employer buys that hype, you may find yourself with no way to opt out." So, Emily and Alex, what are listeners supposed to do if they see some of these AI tools coming at them and they don't want to get to a point where they're required to use them?
Yeah, I mean, well, we're already seeing that, and we're seeing that there's requirements to be using these tools. I chatted with Noam Scheiber at the New York Times about this quite recently, and he just published an article where he had spoken to a few different folks at Amazon. And it's very interesting to hear this coming from people who are white-collar workers at Amazon, but many of them have effectively said that they're being forced to use these tools in doing their coding work. And so a lot of this, you know, we'd imagine coding as one of these things that we were told that everyone should have learned how to do, you know, 5-10 years ago. And now these workers got into coding and now have to use these tools. And so many of them have said, you know, this looks a lot more like warehouse work. It looks more like work where we're being asked to produce so much more in so much less time. Now, the original question was, how do people push back against this, right? And there have been cases in which certain organizations, certain labor unions, one of them being the Writers Guild of America, has had provisions written in their latest contract in which they can't be compelled to use these tools on the job. If they're given synthetic text, they have to be informed about it. They cannot be compelled to, say, get synthetic text and rewrite it as if it is something that needs to be edited rather than original in an original script. So there are workplace protections that are in place or can be in place by folks who are in labor unions. But of course, that is a minority of workers in the US at least. And so a lot of the other strategies have to be a bit more creative in that sense, as if not using it or being compelled to argue with management that this is not something that's actually going to increase productivity, and it is something that is environmentally ruinous, and it is actually adding more labor to what that worker is doing.
And we really hope that the book will help people make those arguments. That's part of what we were doing, is pulling this together and stating things in a way that is sort of free from the hype and does not accept the premise that these things are beneficial, so that people have an example of how to make this argument and hopefully bring it to work. I have a recent example. A friend of mine who works as a nurse in general internal medicine and has a lot of her work involved in responding to patient queries that come across the portal was informed that she's not using the large language model enough. That apparently this thing was installed, and then there's surveillance of how much people are using it. And she doesn't like it because she finds that it is wrong and hard to fix and impersonal. And she prefers to do her own work. And she was chafing at being told that she was supposed to use it more. And so my hope is, beyond encouraging people to look into organizing if they don't already benefit from a union, we are also making it easier for people to have the conversation and say, you're hearing all of this stuff, you're hearing all of this marketing, but I can speak to you from my expertise as the person who does this work and say it is actually not beneficial. And then aside from that, look what I've learned about how harmful it is, all of the externalities of creating and using the software.
I'm glad you brought up healthcare just there because I wanted to touch on the subsequent chapter to the labor chapter. This one has a subtitle, AI Hype and Social Services, in which you go deep into how AI is affecting healthcare as well as other social services. But on the point of healthcare, you write that the push for AI in healthcare won't broaden access. What it will do is worsen the working conditions of nurses and other healthcare providers while widening the gulf between those who can get quality healthcare, which will remain provided by humans, and the rest of us who will be left with cheap electronic knockoffs. And I thought that was a good distillation of your very persuasive argument here that's warning us against accepting or investing so much of AI into healthcare processes and relationships, because the promise from Silicon Valley is, oh, we're going to democratize care. Everyone is going to have access to these great tools. They're going to scale so nicely. And you're saying, no, actually, just the opposite. It's going to widen the inequality that's already in the system.
I think one of the examples of so-called AI systems in healthcare that people are frequently pushing are these systems that do what's called ambient listening. And so it's continually recording the interaction between the patient and the provider and then writing up a summary or a clinical note afterwards. And that is so invasive and awful on so many levels. But if we just focus on this particular point, which touches both the labor issue and the social services issue, it is sold as, well, this is going to free the doctors up to have more time for patients. And on the surface, that sounds like, oh, good, when I'm there, the doctor will spend more time with me. But in fact, more time for patients means we are going to treat the doctor's day like an assembly line, and they're just going to have to see, which is already true, but even more so, patient after patient after patient. And any time savings that is gleaned does not accrue to the physician, right? So working conditions get worse. Things do not improve for patients. And in fact, it's going to deteriorate for patients because the work of thinking through what's happened in that interaction and crafting the clinical note is part of the delivery of care. And to say otherwise is once again dehumanizing what it is to be, in this case, a medical provider and a patient.
Yeah, I mean, I think another thing to mention here is kind of this is a kind of way in which it could be a vector of expanding inequality. And we mentioned that we say in the text, Greg Corrado, who's the head of health AI at Google Health, says something of a medical large language model that doesn't perform too terribly well according to taking a medical licensing exam. Actually, no, it's a test that Google used or developed themselves that's asking medical questions. And so he says something of the nature of, I wouldn't want this tool to be part of my family's own healthcare journey, but I think it still has a bunch of promise. One of the things that comes out of that is there's a sense that, well, these people are getting these robots or getting this text extrusion, and that's better than nothing. I'm like, well, is that better than nothing? In many cases, that's going to give misdiagnoses. That's going to be an excuse for not putting investment in certain communities, for being more serious about public health. And so you could see how this is a potential vector of expanding inequality by suggesting that there is a techno fix for healthcare, when in fact there isn't a techno fix of healthcare. This is a social issue, this is a political issue, and fixing health inequality takes real work and real resources.
And whenever anyone says this is better than nothing, I think the follow-up question is, well, why is the alternative nothing? How did we get into this position, and how do we get out of it so that we actually have, in this case, real healthcare available to everybody in the community or you know, political entity in question?
Yeah, I like how you put it in the book. When someone suggests a robo-doctor, robo-therapist, or robo-teacher, we should ask, why isn't there enough money for public clinics, mental health counseling, and schools? Text synthesis machines can't fill holes in the social fabric. That's such an obviously true statement, but it needs to be said. We need a book like this to remind everyone that the promises of these machines are not going to fix the underlying problems. It just seems like the billions and billions of dollars of investment that are going into these large language models and other AI platforms, just think what we could do if we could have somehow deployed that investment in actual fixes.
Yep.
Yeah, totally. But you know, Mark, fixes don't make money and they don't attract venture capital.
Yes, well, if you would use my Social Fabric Fixer 2000, it's going to scale and be amazing. There's my pitch. I don't know.
Now, yeah. Now I want to see in some zine, some illustration of the Social Fabric Fixer 2000. That sounds
it's
like
just it's just a huge needle and thread. And it's, I'm imagining the social fabric is like a time-space continuum sort of knitter.
And it's vibrating at high speed, and then the next frame it veers off suddenly because it got knocked off course.
Yeah, exactly. It's too heavy.
Well, let's talk a little bit about solutions. You devote an entire chapter at the end of the book called, and you're, I guess, channeling your internal Cher, Do You Believe in Hope After Hype? And I'm guessing that both of your answers would be yes, based on what you said, because you have some good suggestions here. I'll just start with an example. In a section called Everyday Resistance, you write, as a consumer, you have the option to simply not use AI tools. I'll note that you're saying consumer, not employee, because a lot of people as employees are forced to use AI tools. And then later in the chapter, you add, never underestimate the power of saying no. And I like that because I end every show, every Tectonic episode ends with me telling people to say no to four different companies. But say more about that, the power to say no.
One of the discourses that we're up against is a discourse of inevitability. So you'll get the tech boosters saying AI is a thing, it's inevitable. You get the doomers saying it's a thing, it's inevitable, it's coming no matter what. But you also get people who are neither of those camps saying, well, it's here to stay, so we have to learn to live with it. And what I say to that is that this discourse of inevitability coming out of the tech companies is an attempt to steal our agency. And it's really important to retain that agency and say, no, I don't believe you. The future is not written. Every time we opt out, we sort of strengthen that no. And here I really appreciate the work of Dr. Joy Bulamwini and the Algorithmic Justice League. It is thanks to their work that when you go to the airport and TSA would like to take your picture, there's a sign there saying you can opt out. And I do, because I think that every time I opt out, I'm reinforcing for myself this is a thing, and also for people around me. And I think the same applies, you know, facial recognition technologies are sold as AI, same applies to other so-called AI technologies.
Yeah, saying no is very powerful, really trying to find ways of rejecting. And I mean, it's unfortunate that there's these situations and that in which there's employees that can't say no. And there's, I mean, it goes beyond generative AI as well, right? There's a lot of places where people can't say no because they are subject to the decisions of automated decision-making systems, right? And that's always going to be people who are more vulnerable, who are more subject to quantification of algorithmic sorting. I mean, we're all subject to it, but the consequences are much more dire for people who don't have the resources to contest those things, to contest decisions. We're at the point where these technologies are so new. I mean, it's reading Karen's book, it's a trip down memory lane because OpenAI didn't even start. I mean, I think the GPT-2 paper was released in what, 2019, and then the kind of scaling laws and then ChatGPT was released in 2022. And now we're just going whole hog on this. But this, I mean, Emily and I started our podcast in 2022 before ChatGPT even came out. I mean, we've been calling out hype for longer than ChatGPT's been out. And so we've been kind of in at the front lines of this. And so there's still a way to resist and push against these things. I mean, we're not at some kind of inexorable march towards, you know, a great technological future. You know, we have the ability to build more democratic outcomes, and that has to do with a lot of pushing and trying to offer some ability to counter govern what we have here. I'm stealing this term counter govern from Blair Atiyah-Frost, who is a Canadian scholar of AI. And so, you know, there are ways that we can push back both individually and collectively.
I did want to make sure we said a word about your podcast. It's called Mystery AI Hype Theater 3000. It's a podcast, but you also have a recording of the live stream video. And I'm very happy to say that the video archive is not on YouTube, but is instead on PeerTube. I'm so happy to see people using that. At some point, I'm going to do a show on YouTube and other big tech alternatives. And I'll link to your show on the playlist. Tell us a little bit about Mystery AI Hype Theater 3000.
So Mystery AI Hype Theater 3000 is an accidental podcast. When we started doing it, we did not know we were making a podcast. We were doing a live stream to try to take apart this hype artifact that we had found that was just too big to do in our usual textual format. And there's a longer version of the story, which is recounted a little bit in the preface to the book. But let's just say that Alex, being an actual MST3K fan, and me with knowing the concept of MST3K, Mystery Science Theater 3000, which is what we are riffing on there. Alex jumped in to say, I can do a Twitch live stream. One of the things that's been delightful in this process is that we have a pretty strong community of people who come to the chat and interact with us during the live stream. So the videos are there. You can see it. We try to be sensitive to the fact that it's also going to be consumed as a podcast by many people and describe what it is that we're looking at as we take apart these hype artifacts. But it is the source for a lot of the material in the book, both in terms of the specific examples that we come across, but also for the ethos of snark and fun and what Alex termed ridicule as praxis.
Yes, I have nothing more to add to that. I appreciate it's been a really nice kind of community to cultivate too. We've gotten, you know, innumerable people reaching out to us saying this is a really helpful resource. This has been helpful to also push back at work or push back in my community to provide some resources to really think about a way of pushing back on the intrusion of kind of a technological future that we don't want and we didn't ask for. And so that's something that that's really heartening and really finding, you know, we've had a lot of people on our book tour coming up and say they listen to the podcast. That's very cool, meeting a lot of those folks as well.
Well, between the podcast and this book, you're providing us with a lot of resources for how to understand this tsunami of AI hype and what we can do about it. I really like how you summed it up in a couple of different parts of the book, saying the relevant issues are neither technological nor even mathematical. They are ethical, which is a point I hammer on this show a lot. And then in another part of the book, there's a pithy statement that I think could have worked as a subtitle for the book. You write, "We can't technology our way out of it." And I think that's a good rallying cry for all of us. We cannot technology our way out of this. But what we can do is read this book. It's called The AI Con, How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the Future We Want, by my guests today, Emily M. Bender and Alex Hanna. Thanks again so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining several minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with Emily M. Bender and Alex Hanna, co-authors of The AI Con, How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the Future We Want. It's just out, and you can find a link to the book on a non-monopolistic bookstore at the playlist at tectonic.fm. Go to tectonic.fm and you can find the link there to The AI Con. I appreciated this book on a number of different angles. As you heard in the interview, they're covering both the promises, the overinflated promises, the grand pronouncements of the tech bros, and the reality of what these platforms actually do. And there's one aspect of the book that I didn't really get into in the interview, but I think it's important to add here, which is that in a few places in the book, Emily and Alex state that they're not against AI. They actually, in a couple of places, they list some uses of AI that are positive and helpful and useful. Generally, they prefer the term automation to AI because, as Alex said in the beginning of the interview, AI is this catch-all amorphous term that means all sorts of things. So they, Emily being a linguist, they use their language very carefully. And so really they're saying automation, or what we could say automation with digital systems, can be good, can be helpful. You know, an easy example is when you go into the doctor's office and there's a blood pressure monitor. If you go in for a physical or whatever, they put the cuff or something on your arm, and there's a machine that takes your blood pressure, and it does it automatically. That's fine. There's nothing exploitative or harmful about a machine that automates taking your blood pressure. I mean, that's just one easy example. They give some other examples in the book. My point is that this book is not a diatribe against AI as an idea. It's the uses to which these unethical big tech corporations have put AI that are so exploitative and harmful, you know, to labor and to vulnerable populations and everything we were just talking about and more. We didn't get into everything they mentioned in the book, obviously, but you get the idea from the interview, the sorts of concerns that they are accurately bringing up. It's not about AI. It's about the uses to which AI is put based on the growth at any cost business model of these completely unethical corporations. And I think that's an important distinction, that those of us on this team, the Tectonic team, where we are looking critically at technology and trying to find ways forward in a technological society, we're saying, let's try to find ways that are helpful and useful and positive, where we can deploy technology that improves society somewhat. And let's avoid the cases where technology is harming people. I mean, it's such a simple calculus. And the problem, friends, is that the economy seems to be run today by a handful of companies that are determined to deploy technology, and as I said, AI is the latest fad, in a way that is as harmful as possible in order to monetize it and to follow their growth at any cost dreams. And so they sell those dreams to us with these crazy promises that simply are not true. And it made me think, you know, what's a good way to, I don't know, dramatize this or explain it or have a little fun with this. And I came up with this little parable. And if you'll humor me, I want to try this, okay? This just kind of popped into my mind in the past week. And this parable goes something like this. Silicon Valley comes to us, let's imagine, with a new pronouncement. And they say one day, we have come up with a new business model. And you're going to be so excited about this, just as excited as we are. And the business model is as follows. We have found a way to monetize taking hammers and beating baby seals to a pulp. Yeah, I know, it's exciting, isn't it? If you take a hammer and you beat baby seals into a bloody pulp, we in Silicon Valley have figured out a way to monetize that. And so we want you to be excited about it as well. Taking hammers and beating, just pounding baby seals until they're just, you know, just a bloody mess. Is it going to help our growth at any cost dreams? And you are going to love it. And the tech critics among us, seeing this and hearing this pronouncement from Silicon Valley, immediately say, are you crazy? That is evil. That is depraved. That's wrong. And what's more, you have to be stopped. There's something wrong with you even to come up with that idea. This is completely wrong. We're going to oppose it with everything we've got. And here's the punchline, friends. Silicon Valley's response to the tech critics who don't like the idea of taking hammers to beat baby seals into a pulp, Silicon Valley would respond as follows. Why are you against hammers? Silicon Valley would say, who are these losers who are against hammers? Like, why are they so obsessed with hammers? What, do they want to go live in a cave? You want to turn back the clock to a time before hammers? I mean, how are you going to hammer into anything into the wall without hammers? Why are you so against hammers? And so, in other words, friends, Silicon Valley takes the legitimate criticism of their horrible schemes and they derail it. You see how they do that? They try to divert our attention to this narrow, unfairly narrow interpretation of the criticism by saying, oh, why are you against technology? Why are you against calculation or whatever? And the critics are trying to say, no, we're not against technology, we're against the exploitative use of technology. Nothing personal, tech bros, but we're not against these machines per se. We're against you and what you are doing to the rest of us. And I think that's such an important distinction for us to make. And so, friends, when you go out and you talk to friends and you try to explain to them why you want to resist these exploitative technologies, don't let them tell you that you're a loser and you're against hammers. Don't let them do that. Explain to them, as Emily and Alex have, explain to them what's wrong, what's going wrong, and who's being harmed by these platforms. And maybe you will help bring some others onto our team of tech critics as well. And remember, as Emily and Alex said, never underestimate the power of saying no. And with that in mind, friends, I have some homework for you for next time. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. See, those are four no's that you can make. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County, and 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. And I'm off next week, friends. The great DJ Matt Warwick is going to be doing a Tectonic call-in show next week. So I know you will enjoy that, and I'll see you in 2 weeks. And our outro this evening, thanks to my friend Dave Mandel for suggesting this, is a song by XTC, all about surveillance, called Real by Real. Have a good one, everybody, and I will see you next time. Yeah.
I really want to hear the rest of that guitar solo, ladies and gentlemen, but time marches on. And on those many notes, welcome to another installment of It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. We come to you every Monday evening at 7, following Mark Hurst and the Tectonic Show. Welcome. Always great to be here. No seat I'd rather be sitting in than this one right here. And thanks for joining me. We're going to start tonight's show with something newish. That is, 2014, something from 2014. This is a group called Cleft. They are from Manchester, and we're going to hear a short-ish track from an album called Bosch, B-O-S-H, with an exclamation mark. I've vowed to stop screaming album titles or song titles with exclamation marks on the end. I'm not going to scream out Bosch. Even though there's an explanation, I'm just going to say Bosch. That's the title of this album. Again, the group is called Cleft, and we're going to hear a track called 12 Second Panda. Oh, that's my cue. Music there from the group Cleft, C-L-E-F-T, and a track called 12 Second Panda from their album Bosch. You add the exclamation mark at the end if you like. And again, that's a 2014 release, I think, yeah, and they're from Manchester, UK. Up next, I'm going to play something else on the recent side. We're going to hear something from the group Vampilia, who are Japanese, from Japan. And this is a slightly longer track. And I'm going to be a complete spoil sport party pooper here and warn you that it's going to get very loud. It starts quiet and orchestral and gets more proggy and much louder. So take whatever auditory precautions you need to. But a great track here from the group Vampilia.
Oh.